adrenal hyperplasia. There are numerous other entities that we have lots of evidence of safety and efficacy that we apply to using in gender-affirming care. Surgeries are something that often does not happen until someone is much older. Quite often, they'll have what's typically called top surgery as a first procedure done. These are irreversible treatments, as are the hormonal treatments. And there are other examples of body modification in teenagers, such as rhinoplasty, nose jobs. Sometimes you'll see beautiful teenage girl wanting a nose job because she thinks her nose is too big. That's irreversible. Why would it be allowed for her and not for somebody who is transgender youth? We would also have breast augmentation or breast reduction in teenagers, which is allowed surgery. Why would that be allowed, but this wouldn't? It just makes no sense whatsoever.
As we begin to wrap up, Chase Strangio, with more than half of states already having bans, a recent Washington Post report found school hate crimes rose sharply in states with anti-LGBTQ laws. Can you talk about at every level what happens from now on? You've got this House vote, it goes to the Senate. What do you expect? And what do you expect in states across the country?
Yeah, unfortunately, what we're seeing on every branch of government across the country is these escalating attacks in schools, in healthcare, in access to identification documents. Hopefully, people will continue to mobilize. This will not pass the Senate. Dr. Birnbaum won't have to worry about cutting off care to his patients, but because of a threat of criminal liability. But nothing is for sure. We have to take action. And yesterday, in that HHS press conference, you had the Deputy Secretary of Health talking not about health, not about science, but about a principal evil in relation to the rejection of what God intended of us. That is not about science. That is about a wholesale rejection of trans identity. We have to be attuned to that, and we have to be mobilizing to stop it.
And the Senate, what do you expect, and how are you organizing?
Right now, this is a bill that has passed the House. It goes to the Senate, and we all have a role to play. We need to contact our senators and make sure they do not vote for this criminal. They need 60 votes in the Senate, so hopefully the caucus sticks together and stops this from passing. But nothing is a sure thing, so we need people to mobilize. I'm optimistic that this will not become law, but again, we can't take anything for granted. We have a president that is threatening on every metric to coerce the shutdown of this care nationally, and that's on us to organize and mobilize, and we're doing that, but we need everyone to join us.
Chase Strangio, co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union's LGBTQ and HIV Project. Dr. Jeffrey Birnbaum, pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist who works with transgender youth here in New York City. We thank you both for being with us, and we'll continue to cover, of course, this story. Coming up, we look at the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who was wrongfully deported to El Salvador earlier this year. Last week, he reunited with his family after months in ICE detention back in the United States, but his ordeal is not over. Stay with us.
Swallow my pride, step into the light. Don't wanna be nothing. I just gotta jump in right into the deep side. As long as I know I try.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the extraordinary case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the Maryland dad who first made headlines in March when he was wrongfully deported to El Salvador, where he was held in the notorious Secat megaprison. In June, He was returned to the United States, but his ordeal continued as the Trump administration threatened to deport him, first to Uganda, then to Eswatini and Liberia, three African countries he has no ties to. Well, last week, a federal judge ordered him released from an ICE jail in Pennsylvania. Abrego Garcia spoke to supporters after he reunited with his family.
Yesterday, after my release, the first thing I did and the only thing I did was enjoy time with my family. These are times we're living in, Christmas time, a time when harmony, love, and peace are paramount. Being with family is love, and that is what I did. I was with my family, who mean everything to me. I stand here before you in the fight. The fight will continue. I will remain standing. I will not bow my head to anyone. I will always stand against all the injustices this government has committed. No matter what this government says, in the end, I still believe this is a country of laws, a country of justice, and we will put an end to all this injustice.
That was Kilmar Abrego Garcia speaking last week. We're joined now by one of his attorneys, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what is happening right now.
So on Thursday morning, the federal district judge in Maryland, Judge Zenas, ordered that he be released. And she gave two reasons for that. The first reason is what you could say fairly is a technical reason, that back when he was in immigration proceedings in 2019, the judge did not properly enter an order of deportation. Really, essentially, there was a particular form that was supposed to be filled out that the judge did not fill out, which is an order of removal form. And so, therefore, he can't be held pursuant to an order of removal that doesn't exist. That's the kind of hyper-technical, you know, get him off on a technicality reason that everyone's focused on. But I'm really trying to focus more on the second reason that she gave, which is that even assuming that there is an order of deportation, or rather, even if there were an order of deportation, the only permissible purpose under the Constitution for immigration detention is in order to remove somebody. Well, the government's course of dealing since August shows that they've been detaining him not in order to remove him from the country, but rather in order to keep him locked up. Right? They're locking him up in order to lock him up, not even to actually deport him to Africa, but just to keep him locked up. Right? As you'll recall, there's a criminal proceeding. They tried to get the criminal judge to keep him locked up. The criminal judge wouldn't do it. He ordered him released on his own recognizance. And so therefore, they're trying to use the immigration detention to accomplish what they couldn't accomplish in the criminal detention system. And the judge in Maryland held that that's impermissible. It's a violation of due process, and ordered him released on that basis as well.
So you have them trying to send him to an African country, and it's not clear, like Eswatini, like Liberia, like Uganda, it's something that he has no connection to. It's not clear if the U.S. has agreements with these countries to imprison him there. But the place he's closer to here in this hemisphere, Costa Rica, they said they refused to take him. But then Costa Rica said, we never refused to take him. He can come here. What's the deal, Simon?
Yeah, back in August, Costa Rica offered Mr. Abrego Garcia refugee status in that country. Right. So that's a permanent status. It means that he can live there permanently without fear of eventually getting kicked out to El Salvador. You know, he can work there. He can establish a life there, right, if he so chooses. Now, of course, we understand that this is not justice, right? Justice would be that he gets to stay in Maryland where he's, you know, got a U.S. citizen wife, U.S.-born child, built a life, you know, union worker, et cetera. That would be justice. That said, you know, he recognizes, given the considerable power of the U.S. government to make his life miserable, that going to Costa Rica is essentially an acceptable outcome compared to being sent to some African country where A, he doesn't know what his conditions are going to be, but perhaps even more importantly, B, he's got no guarantee that those countries are actually going to let him stay there and not re-deport him right back to El Salvador, where he was already tortured in prison earlier this year. So that's why right now, essentially, the fight is around, his ability to go to Costa Rica, right, and take advantage of this offer of refugee status that they've given. So what the judge in Maryland held, what she found, is that if they were really trying to just deport him, right? I mean, the ICE can detain someone in order to deport them. That's true. But if that's what they were actually trying to do, he'd have been in Costa Rica months ago. And so clearly what they're trying to do is something else entirely.
And what is that?
Well, punish him, right? Punish him for being, so bold and to speak up for his rights to not be deported in violation of a court order. I mean, it's about him. I don't want to take the focus off of him because he is a man, you know, with a wife and a child. But it's also about the government using him more or less at random, right, to stand for the principle that they get to do whatever they want, whenever they want, to whomever they want, and specifically courts can't stop them, right? So this is really a battle between the executive and the judiciary, and he's just being torn asunder, by these two sort of competing forces.
I know you have to go. So what happens now with Paula Zinnes's order, the judge?
Well, we have a hearing on Monday afternoon in federal district court in Greenbelt, Maryland, at which it's going to be determined whether ICE can rearrest him, right? What are the conditions? They tried to rearrest him on Friday morning, the very day after he was released. We rushed into court overnight and got a temporary restraining order preventing his immediate rearrest. He would have been, if the government had its way, he would have been out for literally one night before being rearrested the following morning. But now Judge Zinnes is going to have to decide essentially what are the terms and conditions going forward, right? Under what conditions can he be rearrested by ICE? Does she have power to order them to deport him to Costa Rica? There's a lot that's still on the table.
And the effect on Kilmar, his wife, the child?
I mean, it's been an utter roller coaster, right? You know, Thursday morning, he woke up in the detention center thinking it was just going to be another day. Late morning, they're telling him, we're releasing you this afternoon. As he's walking out the door of the detention center, he gets a notice that he's going to be rearrested the following morning, that he has to go to an ICE office, which obviously is for rearrest. That night, we file a temporary restraining order. We receive the temporary restraining order from the judge literally as he's walking up the steps into the ICE building, right? So he's, gets in the car that morning, not even knowing if he's going to come back home that afternoon. By the time he hits the door of the building, he knows that he's got an order from a judge at least protecting him in the short term. But that order is a very temporary order. It only lasts through Monday, right? And on Monday, this coming Monday, the judge is going to decide what happens next. So it's been one earthquake after another for him.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Simon Sandoval Mosenberg, lead counsel for Kilmar Abrego Garcia. We'll continue to follow the story. Coming up, we'll stick with the issue of immigration, looking at the Trump administration's plan to ramp up efforts to strip the citizenship of hundreds of naturalized Americans. We'll also talk about birthright citizenship, and we'll look at what the Justice Department, what the Department of Homeland Security said yesterday in response to the alleged shooter in the Brown University case and the murder of the MIT professor, saying that they are halting the diversity visa program, which is a green card program. Stay with us.
Glory, glory, hallelujah, since I lay my burdens down. Glory, glory, hallelujah, since I lay my burdens down. Every round goes higher and higher since I lay my burdens down. Every round goes higher and higher since I lay my burdens down.
Hallelujah, set performed by Rising Stars Fife and Drum Band at the Brooklyn Folk Festival in November. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's ramping up efforts to strip more naturalized immigrants of their U.S. citizenship. That's according to a report in the New York Times, which found internal guidance issued this week to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services field offices asked that they supply Office of Immigration Litigation with 100 to 200 denaturalization cases per month in the next fiscal year. The Times reports it would represent a massive escalation of denaturalization in the modern era. The news comes less than 2 weeks after the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case to decide the constitutionality of President Trump's executive order aiming to end birthright citizenship. To talk about all of this, as well as the latest threat by the Trump administration that was issued last night to end the visa diversity program, which leads to a green card for so many, we're joined now by Mei Nai, professor of Asian American Studies and History at Columbia University. Much of her work focuses on immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Nai. It's great to have you with us. Let's start off.
Thanks for having me, Amy. Great to be here.
Explain for people who don't quite understand, what is it to be a naturalized citizen? And then what does it mean that the Trump administration wants to revoke that citizenship from 1 to 200 people a month?
The United States has two kinds of citizens, those who are born in this country, who are automatically citizens by birth. That's what we call birthright citizenship. And naturalized citizens, those people who are immigrants, who can apply to become a citizen after they've been here for 5 years, take a test on civics, have no criminal record, etc. The Constitution treats both kinds of citizens equally. Birthright citizens and naturalized citizens are treated the same under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And we have naturalized close to 10 million people in the last 10 years. So there's a large number of foreign-born Americans who are citizens of this country. Now, to give you some context on what does it mean?
The mayor-elect of New York, right? Soran Mamdani is a naturalized citizen. He was born in Uganda.
That's right. And Trump has explicitly threatened to strip Mamdani of his citizenship.
So keep going with your explanation now.
Okay. So to give you some context, what does it mean to say they want 100 to 200 cases per month? During the first Trump administration, they had 25 cases per year. And before that, for the 15 years before the first Trump administration, they had fewer than 15 cases per year. So this is an incredible escalation. I want to say that it's doubtful that they can actually do this, that they can bring that many cases, or that they can successfully prosecute that many cases. But it's like the mass deportation program. You know, they have no way to reach their goal of 3,000 ICE arrests per month. But they have spread terror and fear throughout immigrant communities, and now that is going to spread to our fellow citizens who are naturalized.
So how does this happen? How does it start? If I were a naturalized citizen, I get a notice that I am going to lose my citizenship?
No, they can't do that. DHS or Citizen Immigration Services cannot unilaterally revoke your citizenship. They have to go to a U.S. attorney, and the U.S. Attorney's Office has to file a civil suit in federal court, and it has to go before a judge. So it's a long process. Every individual case has to be tried. And let me say, Amy, the grounds to denaturalize a citizen are very, very narrow indeed. You have to show that the citizen lied on their application in a way that was meaningful to the outcome. So, for example, we mostly know about people who were war criminals who hid their past, people who were members of the Nazi Party during World War II. Those are the most famous cases. So you have to have misrepresented yourself and hidden or committed fraud on your application about something that would have been consequential. Now, in June, the Trump administration expanded the list of reasons why they could revoke somebody's naturalization. These include association with gangs or cartels, people who have been involved in human trafficking, people who have committed financial fraud against the government or private individuals or entities. That's an interesting one. And so they have expanded the grounds considerably. And speaking of Mamdani, I think one of the things we have to be very concerned about is their use of political difference with the Trump administration. I can imagine that they will selectively try to prosecute American citizens who are naturalized, who have spoken out against Israel's genocide in Gaza. Mamdani has been accused of being, you know, a Hamas supporter, which is not true, but he does support Palestine. So this is going to be, I think, a new ground upon which we see the struggle for political speech.
You say that both birthright citizenship and naturalized citizenship are protected by the 14th Amendment. So go now to birthright citizenship and what's going before the Supreme Court.
On day one of Trump taking office, he declared he was going to deny birthright citizenship to babies born to undocumented migrants and temporary immigrants, people like foreign students or guest workers. Now, this has been challenged in the courts. It's been turned down by several circuit courts, and now it's before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear it. And this is something that has over 100 years of precedence in our country, and this would be a terrible blow if Trump were to, or if the Supreme Court were to uphold Trump's executive order.
And explain what birthright citizenship is.
It simply means that any person born on the soil of the United States, save for those who are born to foreign diplomats or an invading army, which we don't have that circumstance, but anybody born on U.S. soil is, by that fact, a citizen of the United States. And there are, I think, some 300,000 babies born every year to people who are undocumented or temporary immigrants who have citizenship. I'm a birthright citizen.
Explain.
My parents were immigrants, but I'm a birthright citizen. Well, I was born in this country. I was born in the Bronx. My parents were immigrants. They had come from China, and they later became naturalized citizens. But the time I was born, they were immigrants. And I was born here, and so I'm a citizen.
So let's go to President Trump speaking from the White House in June about his plans to end birthright citizenship.
We can now promptly file to proceed with numerous policies that have been wrongly enjoined on a nationwide basis. And some of the cases we're talking about would be ending birthright citizenship, which now comes to the fore. That was meant for the babies of slaves. It wasn't meant for people trying to scam the system and come into the country on a vacation. This was, in fact, it was the same date, the exact same date, the end of the Civil War. It was meant for the babies of slaves, and it's so clean and so obvious. But this lets us go there and finally win that case because hundreds of thousands of people are pouring into our country under birthright citizenship, and it wasn't meant for that reason.
So talk about what is meant for, Professor Nye.
Well, it was originally meant for the babies of the former slaves. That is true. But it was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1898 in a Chinese case called Wong Kim Ark. And the court said that it applied to the children of immigrants as well, including Chinese immigrants, which the court had no great love for. And at that time, the court said, if we eliminate birthright citizenship for the Chinese, the citizenship of all the children of all the Europeans who've come here would be in jeopardy. So the court knew that this was a far-reaching provision of the Constitution, and it upheld it. And it's been upheld, you know, ever since.
I wanted to go what happened just last night. The Trump administration has suspended the diversity visa lottery program in the wake of the mass shooting at Brown University and the murder of the MIT physics professor Nuno Loureiro. The suspect, which seems to be the same person in both cases, was found dead in a New Hampshire storage facility, self-inflicted wound, named Claudio Manuel Neves Valente. He entered the country on a student visa in 2000. He went to Brown, apparently, as a physics graduate student, was in that building where the young people were shot up this past weekend. So he got a visa, a student visa, in 2000, and then apparently was granted a green card through the Visa Diversity Program in 2017. Now the Trump administration is saying, based on this one person, they're going to end this? What exactly is the diversity visa program, what's called a green card program, and what would it mean?
First of all, I want to say that it's an utter tragedy what happened at Brown and at MIT. And this is typical of the Trump administration to weaponize unfortunate instances like this to pursue a different agenda. The diversity visa program was passed by Congress in 1990. It allows for 50,000 green cards to be given to people in a lottery system. Now, people may know that the regular system, you have to have a family member in this country or a guarantee of employment from an employer. So the diversity option through the lottery is just for anybody. Now, they instituted that in 1990 in the hopes of bringing in more white people, Irish, you know, Eastern Europeans, etc. But what happened in the diversity was that a lot of people who got the lottery were from Africa or other countries. So there have been calls in Congress to get rid of it because it's not what it was intended for, which was to make the immigration stream more white. And I think all of these things are just indices of the Trump administration's bigger agenda, which is to make this country a white Christian nation, to strip people of their citizenship. They're going to go after certain kinds of people. Obviously, we see in the mass deportation system, we see in their end to the amnesty programs and refugee programs, and we see in this the attempt to eliminate the diversity, which actually has to be done by Congress. But, you know, they do all these things because they don't like the color or the politics of the people who come to this country.
Last quick question. A federal judge this week ruled the Trump administration broke the law by limiting Congress members' access to ICE jails. Can you talk about the significance of this? We have 20 seconds.
Well, the Trump administration acts with no oversight whatsoever, whether it's the Supreme Court or Congress. He is acting like a dictator, an authoritarian, and it's just a terrible thing. And the American people have to protest and oppose these.
Mei Nai, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of Asian American Studies and History at Columbia University, author of several books, including the award-winning Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowship programs. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Give a gift and change a life with Giving Machines. This holiday season, from December 6th through 29th at Sawasin Mills, you can help those in need with the touch of your finger. Warm meals, winter clothing, and even livestock are available as gifts at The Giving Machine, with 100% of donations going directly to our sponsored charities. Simply tap, donate, and light the world. For more information, visit www.givingmachinevancouverbc.ca.